Every idea starts with a problem. Warby Parker's was simple. Glasses are too expensive. So they set out to change that. By designing glasses in-house and selling directly to customers, they're able to offer prescription eyewear that's expertly crafted and unexpectedly affordable. Warby Parker glasses are made from premium materials like impact-resistant polycarbonate and custom acetate. And they start at just $95, including prescription lenses. Get glasses made from the good stuff. Stop by a Warby Parker store near you.
Over the past 75 years, more than 10,000 chemicals have entered our food supply, but the EU allows just 300 additives. At Thrive Market, we prioritize quality, banning over 1,000 ingredients found in conventional grocery stores. Our Healthy Swap scanner helps you find better versions of your pantry essentials without the junk, dyes, or fillers, and everything is delivered right to your doorstep. So shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health at thrivemarket.com/get started for 30% off your first order and a free $60 gift.
The human brain is meant to operate as a pack mammal, meaning that we are meant to feel safe when we are in close, safe proximity with other mammals. We are accepted by them. We groom with each other. We co-regulate. We feel safe against predators when we have a close, connected tribe where we will not be cast out. So when we grow up with attachment issues, we are mimicking the conditions of a country like Sierra Leone, where they have such a massively high infant mortality rate and violence rate that the mothers have disconnected emotionally from bonding with their children for the first year of life. Sociologists are studying this right now. When mom is emotionally disconnected from you, for whatever reason, your brain early on says, I must be living in Sierra Leone. Even if you're living in like upstate New York, relaxed in a mansion, if mom is disconnected to that extent from trauma and challenges, your brain tags in and lives as if you're living in those conditions. I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunting you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name. What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I'd like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Very excited about today's conversation. We've got on a returning guest. He is a brilliant man. He is inspiring, and he's a friend of mine. He is the attachment specialist, and this is Adam Lane Smith. Welcome back, man. How are you doing?
Zuby, thank you, man. I am so glad to be here. Your voice has carried me through the last probably 5 or 6 years of building my business. I remember listening to you when I was hustling away at my desk, typing, pushing every little key, making every little dollar I could, and it's carried me up till today. So thank you for doing what you're doing. Thank you for having me back.
Well, likewise, man. It's always a pleasure to speak to you. Now, I know some of my audience will be familiar with you, but not everyone will be. So give them a little background on who you are and what you do.
So I'm Adam Lane Smith, the attachment specialist. I help people build better relationships, especially overcoming lifelong patterns that have haunted them since childhood. I was a licensed marriage and family therapist for many years. I worked with trust fund families, blue collar families. I even worked in corrections with death penalty inmates, helped them stop killing each other or killing other people. Now I try to help couples not kill each other in their home. But especially in the last year, I've really transitioned to helping high performing men, political figures, big executives, big global corporations, business owners with $100 million businesses to enhance their life, enhance their performance, and to find that peace in their heart that they've always been looking for.
What are some of the specific challenges that people in that small, very small percentage of the population we're talking about there, if you're talking about super high performing men, what are some of the unique challenges that they're facing? Because society tells us certainly that these are not the guys who are struggling.
and they're not. Well, from all appearances outward, they are crushing it. These guys are usually great in finance, smart in business. They get accused of being afraid of commitment, but they're not afraid of anything. These are the biggest risk takers on the planet. I'm sure you know quite a few of these guys, right, Zuby?
I could be one, but I can't confirm or deny.
I hear that. I bet if you're like me and like most guys that are operating at a higher level, you probably are around these guys all the time. You grab drinks with these guys, you grab dinners with these guys, and you know that they are absolutely killing it. They're not sitting there crying every night, miserable in their home. But there's one thing that they usually are falling short on. Do you have any idea what that might be?
Tell me.
They usually are struggling when it comes to
calming their nervous system and actually being able to just sit with an evening and really relax into that evening without using substances. If they are with a really good woman who actually is very kind, very sweet, he will have a hard problem where at 5 to 7 months, his dopamine falls off a cliff and he won't feel as connected to her as he used to. They have a very hard time making long-term monogamous relationships work. So they often think monogamy just isn't for them when really their system is tuned a little bit differently. And because they have this long-term lone wolf survival mentality, they can grow a business. They can grow really hard in that first half. But once they hit the second half where they have to maintain relationships, maybe with a board of directors, maybe their other C-suite executives, maybe their team, it gets really hard to maintain that at the top because they can't trust other people very well. So they might turn into micromanagers. They might burn out. They might just feel on the outside. And it really crushes and kills the second half of life. It also begins creating a lot of medical issues for these guys. This is why they have early cancer rates. They have early heart attack or stroke risk. Their risk for debilitating, life-threatening medical issues goes right through the roof, right about 45, 50 years of age. And so they spend the second half of their life, even if they even get the second half of their life, they spend it spending most of the money that they accrued in the first half of their life. So first half looks amazing. Everybody is envious. And right around 35, 40, 45, we see that real big, what they call it, that midlife crisis. We see the midlife crisis, what David Brooks called the second mountain, as you plunge into the valley of depression and just life seems to have no purpose. That's where those guys really fall off. But again, they look amazing the first half.
So when you're talking about these guys, it sounds like you're talking about a tiny percentage of a tiny percentage of a tiny percentage of a tiny percentage of people here. So how big or how small is this pool of people that this even relates to?
Yep. So great question. The research indicates that among baby boomers, this was only about 1/3 of people had what's called attachment issues. And maybe only about half of those people had avoidant attachment style, which is what this is. Avoidant attachment style doesn't mean you avoid risk. It means you avoid negotiation and gentle conflict with other people because you don't believe other people are going to be faithful to you. So you're going to be lone wolf survival mode. I avoid collaborating with other people because it's not possible, if you want to think of it that way. Your brain learned that other people will be arbitrary, unreliable, stressed out, you're goofy, maybe mean. So you just avoid close, intimate relationships in that way. The research shows now, unfortunately, about 65% of Gen Z is afflicted with attachment issues because families have been breaking down so bad. And about, again, half of that roughly is avoidant attachment style. So we're looking at maybe 25 to 30% of the population has avoidant attachment style. Now, not all of them are massively high performing. Some of them are mid-level. Mm. Some of them are going to be executives at smaller companies. So let's say maybe even 10%. 10% of your audience listening right now probably is having this challenge. Although I would assume on your podcast, probably there's more than that because a lot of them cluster around you because you're giving the advice you're giving and they're looking for that value add. They're more likely to listen to podcasts, for example. So it is a larger significant portion of the population than most people think.
Hmm. So it sounds like we're talking about two overlapping demographics here. So you're talking about people, men in particular, with avoidant attachment style, and then these super high performers. What's the correlation between those two things, if there is one?
I love that question. So it is avoidant attachment style itself. It's not a disorder. It's not something that says you are wrong. Avoidant attachment style, it comes from early childhood when we learn through our caregivers, for whoever they are, that they're not going to be there mentally or emotionally for us. They could be mean, abusive. They could just be distant. A lot of my clients who come in, they're surgeons or they're high-level executives and their parents sent them away to boarding school. Mom was really emotionally disconnected. Maybe dad had trauma or was a heavy businessman himself. And they just never learned that anybody else is ever going to be there for them. They say things like, no one is coming to save you. They say, I'll sleep when I'm dead is another one that they like to say. And these are not wrong things, but the idea is that in early childhood, they learned relying on other people is dangerous and unsafe. And I will never do that again, ever. And I'm not going to expose myself to people because I get judged and attacked and they'll use intimacy against me. So I'm going to make sure that I stay away from close intimacy with other people. That's all avoidant attachment style lifestyle is. It makes you amped up. It amps up your sympathetic nervous system really high. And this keeps you on edge. So you're constantly assessing risks. You're constantly aware of the risks in your environment. You burn a lot of energy out in social engagements. You're always tracking what to say next, what this person might be thinking or feeling, how to manage that person. There is an ethical variant of this. And then there's a manipulative variant of this. And then off the spectrum is personality disorders. Those are extremes over here that we won't talk about here today. But the ethical variant in particular are not out to hurt anyone. They have amazing moral code. They have really strong, rigid, internalized sense of right and wrong that they follow very tightly. But they don't explain it to other people or show it. They live it very silently and internally. Because they have that chronically overactive sympathetic nervous system, a couple things happen. Number one, you will not be getting your oxytocin bonding that you need from human relationships. Those receptors are actually blocked. I've been working with Dr. Sue Carter, the leading expert in the world on bonding hormones, and she'll talk to you about how oxytocin receptors are blocked in the sympathetic nervous system. You're not supposed to be bonding in that process. Because your oxytocin is low, your GABA is low, gamma-aminobutyric acid. Now, GABA is an inhibitory neurotransmitter that shuts down the expression, the release, and the severity of cortisol. So without that GABA, your cortisol levels are massively unregulated. So you are flooded with stress hormones every single day, but you're like a fish. You swim in it. You don't realize there's water, so you don't think you're stressed out. These men, high-performing men, think they are the most regulated on the planet, but the problem is that they're constantly swimming in stress hormones they shouldn't be in. So they're actually the most unregulated without realizing it. Because your oxytocin and GABA are low, you won't be synthesizing the proper melatonin. So insomnia is really common in this group. So the sleep quality goes down. And then because you are always in your sympathetic nervous system and almost never in your parasympathetic nervous system, you can't come all the way down and relax. So you can't really synthesize in your rest and digest mode that serotonin. So you're never going to reach that contentment, that happiness you're looking for. Instead, you're going to be cycling dopamine occasionally, which is high-level temptation that a lot of these guys spend their time resisting. And they're very good at resisting it. They have a lot of discipline tactics stacked on top of each other. They have to drive as much scraping the bottom of the barrel for serotonin as they can. So they do an hour and a half, 2 hours at the gym 5 days a week. And they're a wreck if they don't get that 2 hours kind of thing. They are scraping absolute fumes just to keep going. Their testosterone plunges over time because of all this, about 35 to 40. Their testosterone craters. Their human growth hormone goes way down because they're not getting it while they're supposed to be sleeping. All of their hormones, chemicals go down. And this is why come 35, 40, they start having those medical issues as their body degrades and falls apart. All of this is, again, it's the cost of high performance, lone wolf mode in a harsh survival environment, but then carried forward across decades, your body just can't handle it and falls apart. You've got to fix this 30s or 40s so that you can start really refreshing and healing.
Today's episode is brought to you by BitBox. As I'm sure you've noticed by now, inflation is a major issue. The more money that central banks print, the less your dollars, pounds, and euros are worth. When it comes to government-issued fiat currency, inflation is inevitable. That's why for many years, I've been saving in Bitcoin. It's scarcer than gold, and it cannot be inflated by any central bank. But if you're going to buy and hold Bitcoin, it's vital that you store it securely, because leaving your coins on exchanges is risky and leaves them vulnerable to potential hacks. That's where today's sponsor, BitBox, comes in. BitBox is a Swiss-made hardware wallet that allows you to store your Bitcoin easily and safely. It only takes a few minutes to set up a wallet and take full custody of your coins the same way I do. Secure your Bitcoin today with a BitBox. Go to bitbox.swiss/Zuby to get 5% off a hardware wallet today. That's bitbox.swiss/Zuby for 5% off. There's something you said there that particularly stood out to me because I know what you mean, but it also sounds like a bit of an oxymoron. You said something like, did you say harsh survival conditions?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I kind of find that fascinating because we're talking about the modern West in 2024, where their survival conditions, one could argue, are the easiest in any time and place in human history, to the point where we're having many problems being generated because people are so comfortable and there is so much surplus. So I'm curious to know, how do you kind of square those two things? Because on one hand, I get what you mean, and I'm aware of these challenges, and people are dealing with all sorts of rise in mental health issues and stress and depression and suicidal ideation, teenagers with, you know, self-harming, all this stuff is going on, and it's actually spiking. but it's weird to place that next to the fact that it's never been so easy to survive. In fact, obesity is a much bigger problem than starvation or famine or drought or pestilence, all of these things, which all of human history we used to worry about, and we were being killed by left, right, and center. And now we're not worried about that, and we're kind of falling victim to the opposite.
Yes. And I fully agree with you. I love this question. The paradox is here. Let's resolve it. The human brain is meant to operate as a pack mammal, meaning that we are meant to feel safe when we are in close, safe proximity with other mammals. We are accepted by them. We groom with each other. We co-regulate. We feel safe against predators when we have a close, connected tribe where we will not be cast out. So when we grow up with attachment issues, we are mimicking the conditions of a country like Sierra Leone, where they have such a massively high infant mortality rate and violence rate that the mothers have disconnected emotionally from bonding with their children for the first year of life. Sociologists are studying this right now. When mom is emotionally disconnected from you, for whatever reason, your brain early on says, I must be living in Sierra Leone. Even if you're living in like upstate New York, relaxed in a mansion, if mom is disconnected to that extent, from trauma and challenges, your brain tags in and lives as if you're living in those conditions. Then that goes on because the people around you don't intimately connect with you. That's that low oxytocin, low GABA, all of those cycles. And you might grow up with early challenges in your family and in your cycles. This creates what I call the lone ape problem, where very similar brain chemistry to humans is chimpanzees. If we took a chimpanzee, freaked him out and traumatized him about other chimps and how they're going to hurt him, threw him into a dark forest full of leopards circling him, he's going to freak out, grab a sharp stick, climb a tree, and be on heavy risk focus for the rest of his life, desperately fighting for life. Now, even if the leopards are just in his mind and he's just convinced that they're there, even if he's only freaked out by five chimps that he thinks are representative of the entire rest of the population, if he's in a forest that looks dark and scary and he's traumatized about the only chimps he's ever met, he is in lone ape mode where he's surviving hardcore and his brain thinks he's going to die. This is avoidant attachment style. It is very inappropriate for the rest of society. You're not actually going to die if you trust one human being, but there are a lot of broken people who will hurt you. So the threat is real. And here's the second half of that, Zuby. And I love, yes, you pointed out, we have so many problems with how easy our life is. The reason we are creating such an overwhelmingly soft, plushy life is because, again, 50% of millennials and 65% of Gen Z people have attachment issues where their ability to manage higher cortisol is down because they're flooded with cortisol all the time from that lone ape problem. So they are endlessly binging dopamine. They are begging for dopamine. They are begging for safety. They are begging for leaders to come save them and make their nervous system calm down. They are begging for the illusion of that close, intimate, bonded troop of chimpanzees or humans. They are begging for AI to take over and help them feel like they have an AI girlfriend. They are begging for escapism. An average estimate now that is that Americans spend 7 years of their life on escapist entertainment. And those were pre-COVID numbers, by the way, which is worse now after COVID. It's the chicken and the egg. One is leading into the other. And which one came first? It doesn't matter. We've got to fix both. But that's the problem, is convincing yourself that your brain lives in a dangerous environment when in fact you don't.
I'm curious about that 65% number. Where's that from?
Yep. So there's been a lot of research done lately. That's the number that the CDC, the US CDC quotes, is about 65% of Gen Z. Now, the numbers, we're looking at the numbers the CDC is starting to pack in and release from Gen Alpha. They don't have the full data yet, but from small infants, it's not looking good. It seems to be increasing by about 15%. Per each generation across the numbers that we've seen. And there's been multiple studies conducted over the last 40 years from the boomers to the millennials to the Gen Zs. And it's all tracking very consistently. It's going the wrong direction. It's showing a society that is collapsing, even if the machines are still keeping us going.
Do we have data of what it was like for, say, the boomer generation when they were the age of current Gen Z? Because I'm wondering how long this data and even this type of thinking around attachment has even been around. It seems like quite a new idea.
It is. John Bowlby created the attachment theory back in the 1960s. Before then, we really didn't have a name for this, but what we did call it was healthy family bonding. We called it families that worked together or found solutions together. It really just measures the ability to collaborate in good faith and solve problems and then keep everybody's mental health relatively high. It's a normal process that hunter-gatherers would have valued, that families on farms would have valued, that everybody has valued through every history, every culture across the U.S. and across the world, actually. It didn't have a name, but it's always been with us forever and ever and ever. The research that we've done, more anecdotal, through journal entries, through tracking population growth, through tracking trends, through looking at, for example, epidemics of drug use that goes up when a society has attachment issues because people are escaping or coping. When we look at families breaking up and splitting apart and separating more often, we look at incidents, family violence, et cetera, across the world. It indicates that there is a massive rise following World War I as families started breaking down. Also, Industrial Revolution really hit hard and started pulling families apart. People concentrated in the U.S. more into cities. As we started seeing families come apart, they lost a lot of that ability to build trusting bonds. And then there were five networks that also cracked and broke down. In addition to that, the core family, the expanded family, then the kith and kin network. You had the larger tribe, and then you had the religious focus as well, or the philosophical focus, if you will, in some cultures. So all of those safety nets broke down. So people not only didn't get the family bonding that they needed with the family, intimate, close, core family, they also didn't get it with aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents. They didn't learn that someone somewhere will help me. They didn't learn that. So as families fracture, it begins to mimic like what happens when the Vikings sail up your coast and the Danes attack 1,000 years ago, burn your village to the ground, kill everyone, capture you. Now you're back in Denmark as a slave. Now you have to try to survive. You're going to break and either be very approval seeking with anxious style or very distant and disconnected and learn to thrive in a disconnected environment more as the avoidant style, for example. So it's always been with us. We've just given it a name, but we don't have the exact research data, but we have anecdotal evidence that does show it's been getting worse over the last 100 years. That's why we're where we're at now.
I hear that. And the numbers you quote, just to be clear, these are specifically from the USA. Is that right?
Yes, specifically from USA tracking adults.
Got it. Do you know what it's like in other nations? Is there any data on that?
Unfortunately, no. John Bowlby died back in the 1990s. There has not been much research conducted on attachment theory since then. Some like tracking numbers and getting data like this, but nothing across the world because it's not financially lucrative for the pharmacies. You don't make a pill that fixes your attachment issues. You don't make a pill that helps you with your relationships. So it's something that you, in graduate school, they tell you this is not important unless you're working with babies, so don't bother paying attention to it. It is, in fact, the most important thing, as we're learning with all the alternative health pieces that we're fitting together now, but we have not yet given it the research that we need to. Maybe with the incoming administration, we will.
Interesting. Because do you know where my brain is going? And I don't want to be like a stickler for data, but
let's go there.
I'm wondering. What I'm wondering is if you're saying, for example, that 65% of American Gen Z have attachment issues, my question is kind of like, compared to what? Because if something is 65% of the population, how do you determine what's an issue and what is just a normal human thing?
So in psychology, when they classify a disorder, they go back to Freud's definition, which was if it stops a person from building healthy relationships that are sustainable relationships, and or if it prevents them from succeeding in occupation or in school, then it becomes a disorder. So if you can work, and Freud said, if you can work and love, you do not have a disorder. What we're talking about here is these challenges are destroying, for example, romance. We're seeing a massive rise in divorce rates. We're seeing the dating pool really breaking down, and it's harder for a lot of young men today to find partners. The research, I'm trying to remember, I think it was something like 2/3 of men under 25 are single right now, and only 1/3 of women under 25 are single right now. We're seeing the rise of porn addiction, of OnlyFans, things like that. A lot of these are symptoms that point back to the core problem. And the core problem is about 65% of Gen Z people, they can't form the collaborative relationships like you and I just had, where we can actually say, hey, you know what? I'm a little skeptical on this data. Let's walk through that. Okay, let's do that. They can't push like that and then work together calmly. Their nervous system spikes out of control and they become approval seeking, or they attack, or they can't even ask a question like that. If they get in a relationship and say, hey, babe, you know what? I really need some time. And the high performing guys I work with, I really need some time to myself tonight. Do you think that we can do that, where I can just take some time and go breathe? Where he can, number one, say that, knowing that she's going to actually care enough about him to help him do that. And then where she's not going to freak out and go, what did I do wrong? Why do you need time away from? Did I do something wrong? Is it my fault? And that's her or freaking out. Or she says, okay. And then she goes, sits in a corner and cries for 3 hours because she thinks that he's abandoning her. Those are attachment. Yeah, those are the attachment issues. It's not like these people are unfunctioning. They, you know, they're on disability. They cannot maintain a healthy relationship because that over time breaks up their relationship. They are miserable. Their partner gets miserable. It kills their attraction. It destroys their ability to have peace. A lot of these guys that I work with, you know, they can't have a normal conversation with the woman in their life, or they think they can't. So then it runs them into the ground, trying to manage her mood, trying to get his own needs met over here without bothering her with them. Talk about that, connect with there. And again, his oxytocin receptors are blocked, so he doesn't form that deeper, intimate mammal bonding that he needs, that will then foster the lower cortisol for him and allow him at night to say, you know what? I'm going to put my work aside for the night. I'm going to rest. I'm going to actually enjoy this moment. He comes all the way down and relaxes. And that female nervous system integrates with him, pulls him in deeper, saturates him with oxytocin, saturates him with serotonin through various means as good women can, and pull him into his parasympathetic nervous system, where he gets rested and digested and everything digests, I should say. He gets everything he needs. He refreshes his testosterone. Free testosterone levels go up. His productivity improves. His human growth hormone improves. He has higher gains at the gym for less effort. And he crushes it at work the next day because he's calmer and he's able to problem solve even faster. That's how we're supposed to operate. And that's what a lot of these guys are unfortunately missing. That's the piece. It's not making life unlivable. It is robbing us of the richness of life that we are meant to enjoy.
I hear that. What, if anything, are the gender differences and disparities when it comes to attachment and attachment issues?
So this is hotly debated. The research that they've conducted here in the US indicates that more men than women tend to get avoidant attachment, which is, I need to be a lone wolf. And more women than men tend to get anxious attachment, which says, something is wrong with me, I'm unlovable, and I need to earn approval from other people so they don't abandon me. Now, we have specific names for women with avoidant attachment style, and we won't say those names here on this channel, but they're mean and harsh. And we have specific names for guys with anxious attachment style, effeminate, nice guy syndrome, incel, things like that. So we definitely call out the opposites because they stand out as so extreme to us. The masculine and feminine energies are reversed in those people, it seems, in a severe survival trauma kind of way. But largely, women tend to exhibit the please don't abandon me, I'm willing to blame myself behaviors. And men tend to exhibit the I can't trust anyone or open up, I have to figure out everything on my own. That's the break that we tend to see. And a smaller proportion of people with more significant childhood traumas tend to exhibit both, where their attachment issues broke twice. And they are very, very more chaotic and more disconnected from people.
What do you think is the reason for those differences?
Genetics, evolution, God's design. I think that if the Danes sail up your coast and burn your village to the ground and everyone dies and you get taken back at, you know, 4 years old to Denmark, I think that as a man, you have a higher chance of surviving if you don't collapse into effeminate approval-seeking behaviors, but you get pretty ruthless, pretty hard, you buckle down, you work extensively as hard as you can, you pocket every dollar you can, you form no sentimental connections whatsoever, you grind it out, you kill a couple guys, you make it into the group, and they all respect you now, and now you can build yourself up to a warlord. I think that that's a better survival path than please don't hurt me, I will give you whatever you want. That doesn't really engender the same survival aspect for those men, and they won't pass on their genes either. I think that for women, rather than becoming a stone cold, you know, heartless Terminator machine who's willing to have sex for anything and everything kind of thing, that's a smaller portion of the population for women, whether no matter what the red pill circles might say. I think that it's far more likely that they will become self-blaming, approval-seeking, that they will desire the sense of safety through oxytocin. So if a man shows them love and approval, they begin to feel safe in his presence, that they are more likely to be hyper-tuned to make sure the relationship doesn't fall apart. And it also makes them very, very focused, obsessive mothers. So they're more likely to keep their children alive in those raw survival environments. I think that God crafted us that way because he's not foolish. He knows that we're going to do stupid things with each other and wreck each other's civilizations and need to survive. And I think that biology has shifted in those directions to protect us in that capacity.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think there's probably also a nurture aspect to it, because as you're describing these different types of men and women, for example, a man who is avoidant is generally going, compared to anxious, is generally going to be more successful, respected, and attractive to the opposite sex than a man who is on the anxious end. And that's inverted for women. So a woman who is anxious and has this neuroticism and so on, it might be annoying, it might be difficult, it might be hard to deal with, but it's not repulsive. It's not repulsive to a man. It's almost like an extreme of certain feminine coded characteristics. Whereas if a man is like that, it's the same way that, you know, let's say you're out and about, or you're even in the house and like a cockroach or a pigeon or a rat comes away. Like if a girl screams and does, you know, does that, that's kind of endearing and you expect it. If a man screams and like other men are like, bro, man up, right? And women are like, ew, like what's wrong with that guy? Like, in fact, just screaming, like screaming is a female thing. Like a man should not scream. I don't think I've ever screamed in my life. I've shouted, I've yelled, but I've never screamed, right? But if a man screams, both guys and girls are like, whoa, like there's something's not quite wired correctly here. So I think that's also part of the reason. I think that it's, as a man, you're almost like, if you're not going to be secure, attached, and just balanced, you're better off taking the avoidant route than the anxious route. Whereas for women, I think it's the opposite.
I fully agree. And because these attachment issues, they're designed for environments where something has gone wrong, right? Secure attachment forms when things have gone fairly right. It's I don't want to say it's the natural default. We do have to learn into it and understand that it's okay. But when everybody in society is relatively healthy, everything is structured, people follow an honor code, when society is trust-based, when there's a firm religious foundation that doesn't smother individuals but enhances their growth, when everything is operating properly, people tend to form more secure attachments where they can trust each other, they can collaborate, they can work together to solve problems. There will always be outliers who are unhealthy or who have broken families, but by and large, as families get better, secure attachment goes up, society improves. When you have very broken societies where that's not the case, where it's not trust-based, it's legalism, it's individualism to the extreme, every child for themselves starting at age two, when it's we can't trust each other because we have no moral code, when you can walk outside of your house and get shot to death picking up your newspaper, when the politicians are harvesting you, in either party, just as livestock, when nothing is going right and your society seems to be collapsing, you will definitely fall apart into, I can't trust anyone and I'm scared all the time. Now, what do I do about it? Yes, there is a crisis of masculinity. You and I talked about this previously, I think on my podcast. The crisis of masculinity is that masculinity largely died out in the West in a lot of ways. It has tried to come back as a fledgling version of itself, and men haven't known what to do. Men have tried to please women and please women and please women. And there's an outlier group, the avoidant men, who are stepping in and playing games, pickup artistry, picking up girls, even just more ethical variants of, well, we'll connect and we'll try to make it work. But I don't know. I can't figure out this monogamy thing. I think I'm just going to have to break up with you every year or every other year, or, you know, maybe halfway through our marriage, it's just not working out. It falls apart. We have the rise of, I'll hate to say this, we have effeminate men on one side, which women are not attracted to in any way, shape, or form. No woman wants an effeminate man who is scared, nervous, like you said, terrified. And this is really the rise of like friend zone, incel stuff is over here on this side. They're not bad men. They're just completely lacking masculinity, and they're afraid all the time. They collapse into it. The avoidant men at least have half of the equation right. They, in fact, they have the first half. They have a juvenile masculinity, which is questing for personal personal sovereignty. They are trying to build personal sovereignty because they don't trust anybody else to have any sort of control or mastery over them at all. So they are looking for that personal sovereignty, which is the first half of healthy masculinity. But they very rarely transition into the second half of healthy masculinity, which is finding your deeper purpose in service to others. Whether a legacy, whether a cause, building a kingdom, even the king on top of the hill, he is still a servant to his people. He's crafting a nation. He's crafting a people, and he is leading them. That masculinity must lead into the second phase. And avoidant attachment style will help you climb the first hill very fast, but the second hill is inaccessible to you because you have not bonded with people. You don't know how people bond. I think, and the research is spotty on this, so bear with me, the rabbit hole moment, but it seems to be that men who are avoidant never tasted oxytocin as a child, or it was weaponized against them so hard that they formed fear to oxytocin immediately in life. So they never really bonded with mom, dad, anybody intimately. They don't even remember what it's like to taste that safeness with other people. So safety to them has no flavor. They've never understood it, and they don't think it's possible. So they don't become a junkie chasing it. They give in to the idea that they will never have it.
Let me ask a question, Adam. You said you used a really interesting phrase there. You said oxytocin being weaponized. Can you just expand on what exactly that means?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. This is where I think a lot of the red pill dating advice comes from, is oxytocin being weaponized by moms and then later by girlfriends. Women who are much, much more unstable, women who are either severely both blends of attachment issues and traumatized or personality disordered, which the research now indicates is about 15% of adult American women have a personality disorder, possibly up to 20%, but I'm skeptical about that. I think it's 15 is what the research shows. It's a lot. When a mom has that, it's, I love you, baby. You're so special. You're so wonderful. And you do one little thing she doesn't like, and the script flips, and you are evil. You are scum. You are awful. She throws you in your crib and says, that's what you get, and walks away from you and yells at you from the other room. And you cry and cry and cry for 6 hours. And then she comes back when she wants to feel like a good mom. And she says, okay, fine. I'll forgive you. And you're like 2 months old. She hurts you. She yells at you. Even if she doesn't hurt you and yell at you in that way, she makes it so inconsistent of, I will give you love. Now I demand your fealty for my love. You owe me for life. And she punishes you the moment you don't make her feel the feelings she wants to feel. You are nothing more than an object. It's your purpose in life is to make her have good feelings on demand. And when this happens, this creates that oxytocin phobic response, where a man's system actually fears oxytocin because it has been weaponized against him. And he believes that women will utilize this against him, and that when she gives him good feelings, the bad feelings are coming very quickly, and that he's going to be enslaved and enmeshed with her. That's the problem.
Isn't a lot of this, though, just, I get what you're getting at on a deep psychological level, but isn't a lot of it just guys' experiences?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're all experiences, 100%.
Yeah, I don't even mean like in childhood. I mean in teenage years, in young adulthood. I mean, mm-hmm. just being real. I know that, I mean, this is true for both men and women, but so many people's perspectives, which can go overboard and which can become overgeneralized in many ways, oftentimes it's, In my experience, in many other people's experiences, it's kind of it's a result of heartbreak. So you can have someone who is raised very well and has great parents, is from a great family, and so on, and they have this somewhat naive, someone might say, blue pill lens to the world, and they go in thinking, yeah, women are sugar and spice and everything nice and da da da, and they actually do what on paper they're supposed to do. They are that good guy. They are trying to do the right thing. And then they themselves get their heart crushed and torn to pieces. And not just that, but they also see guys who are the quote unquote jerks or the jocks or who are mistreating women or whatever. And the women are interested in those guys. And, you know, this is a typical nice guy thing, right? They're kind of like, wait, hang on. I'm doing the things that I thought I was supposed to be rewarded for. And maybe even in, you know, my grandfather or my great grandfather, if he behaved this way, this is how he got his wife. And now in this super weird society we're now living in, a lot of those things are now punished. So I know for certain that there are a lot of single guys out there who, in their heart of hearts, they would like to be more of a nice guy, but they have just found from their iterations in their dating, someone could argue, hey, well, you know, they're not picking the right guys, or, you know, they're not picking the right women. Just like you could flip that around the other way. But I think we're living in such a strange and inverted moral order and society and culture at this point where a lot of good behavior gets punished. A lot of like doing the right thing can kind of get you wrecked. So there are people who, depending on their personal experiences and maybe what they've seen their father or their brother or their uncles or their friends or whatever go through, that's when the guards come up. Like, they don't really want to have to be so guarded, but they're just like, well, it's stupid not to be, because if I'm not, this can be the result. And I do think there are many people, particularly religious conservative people, the type, you know, who, God bless them, you know, they dated and married like the their high school sweetheart, and they haven't been through this heartbreak and the horrible dating market and dealing with, like, they themselves have not been through any of it. And that's awesome. Like, it's great that they avoided it all. But I think that there is often a bit of a naivety when they're criticizing some of this stuff. And I'm kind of like, I get where you're both coming from here. And I can see why, if someone just, you know, gosh, like some people meet their wife at like 15 or 16 or 17. I'm like, dude, that's amazing. But millions, billions of people don't. And whether man or woman, they sift through quite a lot of, I don't want to say garbage, but they sift through a lot of not so great experiences in order to hopefully one day find that great person and relationship and so on. But people do get very, very jaded and hardened and guarded and avoidant throughout this process, even if their childhood situation wasn't traumatizing or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. I fully agree with you. Let's propose a thought experiment here, and I think I can show you why that's happening, because I agree with you, but there's a second piece that I want to show you here today. Let's propose a thought experiment. Let's say that there are two populations. Let's say that one population does not grow up in it's not a perfect family or even a peaceful family, not even a family where there's no screaming or no trauma. It's a family that they grow up in where they are taught how to have conflict with other humans, how to lean into personal questions pretty quickly, how to be fairly transparent, how to be accepted by others, even if there's questions, even if it's loud and you fight a little bit, but you always come back together to resolve the issues lovingly with transparency and fairness. This is what we would call secure attachment. Okay. It's not peaceful, no fighting. Peaceful, no fighting can also be a broken attachment. It can, the absence of a clear, defined framework for conflict that is transparent and reliable and consistent. That's insecure attachment. You have to have that, whether there's fighting or not. So a family, let's say one population grows up understanding exactly how to build conflict, how to be transparent. They feel accepted by their family. They build friendships with a couple of key people growing up. They understand exactly how to have conflict and be healthy and move forward. They start businesses. They get married, maybe younger, whatever it might be, and they move on with their life. Now, the way that they signal in friendship at the beginning of relationships, the way they signal on first dates, the way that they signal within 3 seconds of meeting you, all of these things are vastly different. The way that they exhibit any sort of conflict resolution whatsoever from moment one is going to sort them out and help them understand what other people are going to do and what other people won't do. Now, if you have a second population that never learns one reasonable, consistent, transparent, and healthy framework for resolving conflict, whether they say everyone avoids conflict and no one speaks about it, we sweep everything under the rug, we never fight, but we also never fix anything. These are the blue pill guys usually that go out and get wrecked in relationships because they're just trying to be kind. Or they say no one will ever work with me because we all scream and fight and punch each other and nothing gets fixed. Or dad was gone and I don't even know what people do. Or mom was a drunk mess. Or mom was such an emotional mess, I had to take care of her all the time and I couldn't even have conflict. I don't know what to do. It's the I don't know what to do and I don't know how to work with people. So I will operate as if other people are a video game. I will push buttons and try to get outcomes, whether I am anxious and doing it from a place of fear and inferiority, or I'm avoidant and doing it from a place of managing other people because they can't manage themselves. I will push buttons and receive outcomes. That population, day one, within 3 seconds of meeting you, is going to signal differently in conflict and how they shake hands and how they make requests of each other and how they share details or don't share details. These two populations, unfortunately, from what I've observed, segregate out from each other without even being aware that the other one exists. Insecurely attached people say, I have never met a secure person in my life, because those people operate differently. These are the people that ghost you. These are the people that seem boring. These are the people that don't open up and flashbang you with feelings immediately. These are the people that just ask you very personal questions that feel kind of uncomfortable, and then the conversation fizzles out and you never talk to them again. That's what a secure person looks like on a date for an insecure person, and they're a little bit intimidating. For a secure person, they look at insecure people, anxious or avoidant, and say, you're pretty closed off. You're not answering the direct questions I'm asking. You seem like you're waiting for me to like flood you with feelings. You're trying to jump into bed really fast, or you're trying to establish physical contact really quick, or you're super shy, or all of your answers are really self-degrading. I'm not really into that. Like, something's off here. So they segregate out without even observing that the other population exists. And that's when I work with a lot of my clients, this is what they transition from, is I've never seen a secure person in my life, and everyone around me is always been X, Y, and Z, to, wow, there are actually a number of really healthy people. I just had to learn how to signal differently and stop signaling to my population over here. That's the shift. And that's the blue pill to red pill shift. That's why I don't buy into that, is because blue pill guys come in very anxiously attached, nice guys, and say, no woman will ever look at me. And maybe I got hurt and chewed up and spit out, and many of them have. And I got truly hurt and I don't know what to do. All I want is to have a family. Please tell me what to do. And the red pill dating teachers usually say, become avoidantly attached, manage her, don't trust her, don't open up, don't share intimacy, don't resolve conflict, control, control, control. And here's all these buttons to push to get outcomes. And that's what they, by and large, what they typically teach. And it's still not solving the problem. It's still not switching from one population to the other. It's assuming there is only a broken population, that there is no hope, and that you now have to become a protective aggressor to try to manage the other person like livestock. The idea, though, is to switch over into the secure pool and connect there. Are there fewer dating partners there? Yes. Are more people waking up every single day? Absolutely. Absolutely. More people are healing and waking up every single day. You can have questions and conversations over there. In fact, you must. Open communication, transparency, all of that is the hallmark of the secure pool. And when you transition over there, everything gets so much better. That's where good life really is.
What's wrong with getting stuck on just getting over that first mountain you kind of talked about, the two stages? What's wrong with just doing the first one?
Well, three things. One is mental, one is physical, and one is spiritual. Mentally, if you are constantly stuck in that first mode, you think no one will ever really work with you. You are very lonely. You default every time in a relationship to something is off. What can I do about it alone without bringing it to the other person? How can I manage my problems in this relationship? At work, how can I manage these problems without ever getting input from my supervisor or my team? How can I get my needs met? How can I convince someone to care about me? You are endlessly overthinking. You expend a massive amount of effort doing that. You'll actually burn your magnesium reserves much faster and leave yourself fatigued and exhausted. Magnesium is what allows you in many ways to overthink. It's one of the primary things that does that. So you'll overthink and be stressed out quite often. And that will be your daily life. So you operate from a very limited perspective. You will not be getting the solutions you need from other people. You're very closed off. So you have to reinvent the wheel and reinvent fire every time there's a problem. You can't go to someone and say, hey, I'm having a challenge. Can you walk me through this? Here's what I'm thinking. You can't really do that effectively. So number one, mentally, you are limited to what you can think up and you're overthinking and stressed out pretty much all the time. Physically, you are in your sympathetic nervous system almost all of the time. Even if you're at a low level where you're just kind of buzzing and grinding your teeth and you can't really focus on what you're doing, you can't relax and enjoy that moment with your girlfriend. You can't sink into bed and turn your brain off. You are still in your sympathetic nervous system, which, as we talked about, increased risk of cancer, massively increased risk of early cancer, 35, 40-year-old cancers. That's one reason we're seeing a lot of that. but physically you're just, you are deeply biochemically unhappy. You're going to be chasing dopamine. You're going to be using drugs. You're going to be using all kinds of things to manage that long-term sympathetic nervous system burn, that fight or flight response chronically activated. You are not meant to do that. You're not meant to be a lone chimpanzee in the forest, clutching a stick, perched in a tree, not sleeping, barely eating, afraid all the time, binging dopamine just to feel okay for a moment. I have to feel alive as I fight for my life kind of thing. You're not physically meant to do that. You will degrade and die, and it'll be pretty bad. And number three is spiritually, humans, and especially our caregivers, are really our first model of the divine. They're the first model of God. I'm a Christian myself, but all the Abrahamic religions talk about God as a father figure, God as a caregiver, a protector. If we don't have a framework for what it is like to be loved by anybody ever, most young people turn away from the church for that reason, because it sounds so alien to them. To be deeply loved by someone who has power over you is an experience many young people have, 65% of Gen Z, have not had. So to try to teach them about a loving God who cares about you, or even to teach them about a state where love is existing and where you are at least nurtured and safe, even with the other religions across the world, it's impossible for them to understand, because biochemically and emotionally and mentally, they've never experienced it. So they scoff at it, or they simply drop it. And when they resolve these attachment issues and get connected with one or two humans, they say, oh, I wonder if this might be what my relationship with God could be like. Maybe I should take a second look. And a lot of people who resolve their attachment issues experience some sort of religious awakening, usually with one of the three Abrahamic religions, and they go back into it and say, maybe I'm willing to take a second look at this. Maybe a relationship is actually possible, where it's not me feeling crushed, disregarded, hated, abused, yelled at, or even just ignored completely, abandoned. And that's it. So mentally, physically, spiritually, we need this secure attachment. We're built for it.
Mm. I hear that. Do you know what worries me about this whole situation, however wide someone wants to cast this net, is people can't teach things that they never learned. So a cycle is created. So if you get to the situation where the majority of the population, like you're saying, the majority of a whole generation has attachment issues and never learned how to attach to people securely, then yeah, sure, some people will learn and be converted, but then they're going to go on and have children and produce another generation where that number is now going to go to 75%. And you'll eventually get to a point where basically, like, you know, devout religious people, well, number one, they'll be the only ones reproducing. But number two, you're going to kind of have like a small pool. Maybe you'll end up with like an 80-20, right? Where you have like 20% of people, they're secure and they're rooted, faith, family, morality, family unit, all of that stuff remains tight. And then you're going to just have, I don't know, 70, 80% of the population where it's like what we're currently dealing with and worried about, but on an even bigger scale. That's the thing. I don't know how to, solving things at scale is always difficult. But I know it's a bit like if someone asks me about the whole obesity situation, right? So obesity in the USA has gone from 5% to 10% to 20% to 30% to 40%. It's heading towards 50% in about a decade from now. And I know how to solve that and help people with that on an individual level. However, on a societal or on a national level, I have some ideas, but I don't really know, like, without massively infringing on people's freedom and having some, you know, horrible authoritarian government, right? Like, I don't know, or just, you know, drugging people. Now you've got like these new drugs, but like, I don't know what you can really do. So anything that has to do with like family formation or relationships, coupling, marriage, all of that stuff, I think what's very complicated about it is the trying to solve at scale. I think that's what's very complicated, and I don't know how that can be done. If it can be done, I don't know how. So I don't know what your thoughts on that are.
Oh, yes. Oh, I love this. Thank you for bringing this up. I could take a stab at it because this has been my obsession. I'm on my personal quest is to teach 1 billion people about secure attachment, because if I could teach a billion, then that jumpstarts the process. Now, I wish I could claim that I invented this. I did not. I did not invent attachment theory. I wish I could claim that people will only get better if I teach them. Well, I don't actually claim. I hope that. But you know, that's not the case. Nature heals, right? When a population is going through an ongoing stressor, they don't get better. But when we end that stressor, and when we correct at least the environment where, okay, the stressor is gone, the beautiful thing about populations is they start healing. In the Bible, it talks about when a curse will follow a generation down three generations out. That's what we seem to see is the dad has overwhelming extreme traumas from something, or his dad makes a horrifying decision that shatters the family. And the next generation is screwed up. They're screaming, they're hitting each other. There's substance use. It's catastrophic. The next generation usually says, and here's an amazing thing a lot of humans do, I will at least be better than my parents, at least a little bit. And they pick one or two things they won't do, and they do a little bit better. Then the next generation says, I will do at least a little better than my parents, and they pick one or two things they won't do. And as they resolve, and as they resolve, and as they resolve, down through generations, eventually, provided that stressor is gone and that they have a little bit of time to heal, they reach a point where they are good, healthy, connected families again. And this idea of secure attachment and resolving conflict, all it is having the guts to talk to each other and trust that the other person is at least going to hear you out and care enough to work with you in a mutually fulfilling kind of way. That's all. People won't exploit me. At least my family will listen to me, and we will try to work together toward a common good in a sustainable way. That's it. And humans reach that. Once we get broken and we start fixing again, we reach that equilibrium again. My goal is to speed that process up for a billion people across the earth and transmit that knowledge and say, look, here's what you were missing. Instead of waiting another two generations, here's your information now. Here's what to start doing. Let's jumpstart your process. But to do that, we need a lot of the stressors taken off of our relationships and our life. We need families to be encouraged to stay together again instead of encouraged to break up. We need risk factors and massive drug epidemics to go down so that people aren't dying in massive overwhelming numbers. We need violent gangs who are intruding across in various nations across the earth and all kinds of war. We need it to at least slow down so that populations can heal a little bit and be safe inside and play in a park. And then when families can play in a park, they can bond. And then they can spend that time pushing on the swings, playing, running, throwing a ball. Then they can bond with each other and build intra-family networks, kith and kin networks, and build neighborhoods again. And this is something humankind has always done since the beginning. We get hurt. We heal across several generations. We reach a healthy place again. We thrive. Then we get hurt again. We heal across several generations. We hit equilibrium. We begin thriving again. We have to end the threats right now against our population, and then across the earth, a lot of threats. And then we have to jumpstart the process so that we're not waiting four generations. That's all we've got to do. I believe that secure attachment, teaching this, is a major part of that. I also believe there's a lot of people that have other work to do to help us end those threats so that families can come back together again instead of being blown apart.
I hear all that, and I like how it sounds. But I have a big single word question, and that is how.
Teach them that it's possible. That's the number one thing I've encountered, is most people just don't even know that this is possible. It's not that they're bad people, or that they don't want to trust other people, or they don't want to open up like you said they do, but they don't even know it's possible because it's never occurred to them and they've never seen it. And if we can just teach them it's possible and help them have one or two small proof of concept relationships, everything is possible. Everything changes from there.
I have a question, Adam, and this is going to be specific to your wheelhouse and your nation. Marriage rates are significantly declining in America and also in other countries, as are childbirth rates. How, if you were in charge, if you were in administration, if Trump double tapped you on the shoulder and said, "Hey, I want you to be, we're going to form a new department. We're going to form the Department of Family Formation and Maintenance," or whatever it's called. What would be your top three policies to fix and help reverse some of these negative trends across the USA?
People change or take action for one of two reasons. One is fear, and the other is desire. I am not the kind of person who wants to operate from fear. I don't think that I think we've had enough fear. I think people are soaked in it. I think that marriage, the reason we're going away from it is fear, because we're afraid of it. We're afraid of vulnerability. We're afraid of loss. It seems stupid and pointless to us now. It seems archaic and useless. I'm a married man myself. I have 5 kids. I've been married. My 16-year wedding anniversary is coming up. So I know it has benefits. It has been a rocket strapped to my back for my progress, for my growth as a man of God, as a businessman. My wife has been phenomenally helpful in that regard. I know not all women are that way, but my wife has been. So here's what I would do. Number one is I would teach people, number one, that a healthy state of thriving in their relationships is very possible. I would give people hope. Number one, that they are not stuck forever, that they're not broken, that it's not just you were born wrong with the wrong chemicals, that you're just screwed up. Sorry, that's the roll of the dice. That good relationships can and must be built, and how amazing it feels. And I would help people understand that that's what they're built for and designed for.
Is this billboards? Is this TV ads? Is this hiring influencers? How would you get this message out?
Love him or hate him, Donald Trump's campaign showed that 3 primary driving vehicles right now are big for the next generation. One is memes. We're seeing the rise right now on social media of Wife Jack talking about how funny it could be to have a wife, right? Stuff like that. But memes that are good and enhance marriage. We have 1 billion memes going back even to The Simpsons, billions of memes across internet and TV showing how bad marriage is. We need memes showing how fun marriage is. And it is. And love, real love. We need influencers and who aren't just like talking like marriage is good, you guys, it's great, but married and happily connected influencers who are sharing what their marriage looks like and how great it is. I love posting when my son and I go on adventures together. Hey, it's his first time doing whatever. It was his first time doing jujitsu the other day. Like, hey, it's my son. He's doing jujitsu. It's so great watching him. And guys, unmarried guys comment and say, man, you're really making me rethink this not having kids thing. It looks amazing to have a son. And that's pumping in. And the last one is podcasts like you. Podcasts where people can come on and have conversations and people can just listen to us because they grew up hearing their parents, probably boomers, say it sucks having kids. It's terrible to be responsible. I hate having children. I hate having you little rats around. You guys take up so much money. Even if it wasn't that explicit, it was bad. But hearing you and me talk right here and talk about how great and fun it is. Yes, it's challenging at times, but amazing to have a family and how fulfilling and enriching that is, especially in that second half of life. Memes, influencers, podcasts. I think those are the big 3 vehicles that I would use to really drive this message.
Awesome. So policy number 2?
Policy number 2. Can I be really controversial for a moment?
Please do, man.
I would end no-fault divorce immediately. Specifically here in the United States, we have a policy for everyone overseas, a policy called no-fault divorce, which just means that for any reason, at any time, you can just get divorced. You can just split up your marriage. I think that this is a misguided policy because it makes a marriage between 2 human beings. And I don't personally believe that a marriage has been or ever was between 2 human beings. It's an agreement that 2 people come together to co-found a legacy or co-found a family, largely is what marriage has always been for. And it's not for sex or romance or fun. It's actually for family and the cultivation of resources, of safety nets, all kinds of things together. I don't think that we should just randomly flip apart marriages and shatter them. I think that that leads to massive, ugly custody battles. It leads to the dissolution of family wealth, crashing people down below safety nets. It leads to brokenness, children not knowing their fathers. It leads to bad things for mothers as well. No-fault divorce is not good for anyone. So if you're going to enter into a marriage contract, I believe that you should be held to it by larger society. That's controversial. Some people won't like that, but I do not think we're going to reverse this ship unless we treat marriage as an actual arrangement that is important instead of a fun little flippant thing you enter into for fun and sex.
I hear that strongly. Let me ask a follow-up question on that.
Yeah.
How much do you think the state or the government should be involved in marriage?
Good question. Ideally, I think it should be involved in marriage about 0%, honestly.
Okay.
Now, that's if you have a thriving community where families are interconnected And the bride and the groom, their families know each other and have for a long time. And their families are connected and their parents know each other and their grandparents know each other. And everyone in the network knows each other. And there is social pressure upon them to treat each other with honesty and respect and kindness. If their kids will grow up and marry the neighbor's kids next door, if we have that level of connection, plus maybe like a religious connection where marriage is being treated as something very important, as a bond, as a sacrament, if you have social pressure with those people, then you do not need the state involved in any way, shape, or form. And in fact, it shouldn't be, because a state should be minimal at best. Okay, but we don't have that. So the state has stepped in a thousand ways and replaced all of those networks that we've had. And we are now all in abusive relationships with the state. That's what the Western world is. Okay, the state has replaced everything and abuses us as a result. We need to diminish that and restore the human connections and networks that actually we are designed for, instead of the state superseding everything. That's my approach.
Yeah, I think it's way, way, way too involved. And I think very few men are afraid of marriage. I think men are afraid of divorce. That's the reality. That's the truth. People like to say men are afraid of marriage and they're just noncommittal and they want to be players. I'm like, no, that's not what it is. They just don't want to, gosh, in the USA, I mean, people debate the divorce statistics, but it's somewhere between 40% and 55% in terms of the raw number, right? It's essentially, yes, of course, there's things you can do to control it to some degree, but it's essentially a coin toss statistically. And the consequences of it not going well, and as you've said, in that no-fault situation, on paper, you could have done everything right. You stuck by your vows. You didn't cheat. You weren't abusive. You didn't do this, right? And you can still get chopped. And it happens to millions and millions of people. And this is the ugly part where this is why the sort of so-called, I've been aware of red pill stuff for 20 years. And it gets strawmanned a lot. But one of the strongest positions, I believe, that comes from that sphere is the questioning around family courts and marriage contracts and the way divorce happens and all of that business. Because I find that so many Christians and so many conservatives, they dodge this issue. They don't want to talk about it. I think they think that by talking about it, it's going to like make it happen or something. But it's, I think by not being willing to honestly discuss this problem, let alone propose any solutions, and just, you know, the advice is just, well, just pick better. You know, some people's advice is, well, just don't get divorced. And it's like, well, it can be a unilateral decision. Okay. If you have this no fault divorce situation and anyone at any time for either person at either time for any reason can just be like, you know what, I'm bored, or I'm not happy, or I met a hot person at work, or whatever reason, and they can just like bounce and destroy this whole thing and sometimes be rewarded in the process. That is so destructive and so perverse. And I truly, truly wish that more people of faith, more people of sound values and morality would be willing to talk about that and address it, because it's not some irrational fear. Millions of people have gone through this. And it's nasty and it's horrible. I'm sure you know many people who have gone through this. I know many people who have gone through this. And that is the part that strikes fear in the heart of people. It's not the idea of committing to one woman or raising a family or having children or spending money on someone else. It's not that. It's just like, hey, if I'm going to do that, I want to know that it's not going to just kind of implode on me, even if I didn't violate the terms and conditions. Like, hey, I played by the rules. I did what I was supposed to do legally, financially, morally, socially, even religiously. And then, you know, when it comes to the family courts, they don't care about your religion. They don't care about for better, for worse, for sickness, for health, right? That's all out the window because of that legal contract. And that has to be addressed. If that is not addressed, I guarantee the marriage rates are going to continue plummeting, because unless that, and that's why people are just cohabiting, men and women, lots of them by the millions, are just like, you know what, let's just cohabit. And I'll be totally honest, from a secular lens, once you take the faith part out of it, that makes a lot more sense to a lot of people than marriage. It makes more sense because if it's just going to be a piece of paper and inviting the government into the relationship, and again, if it can be broken up at any time for any reason, it's just extended dating now with the state involved. So if you're just going to do extended dating, then why involve the state? Why not simplify it? And hey, what if it doesn't work out, you just go your separate ways like you were boyfriend and girlfriend, instead of going through this horrible thing and having your finances torn apart and fighting over custody. And it's an ugly topic to discuss, but it's so common now. You know, if the divorce rate were like 5%, cool. Like, you wouldn't have to really think about it or worry about it too much, because maybe those 5% would be like, okay, yeah, there was actual adultery, or there was some form of abuse, you know, domestic violence, like, cool, like, that's legit. But when it's like half, and some people will be like, oh, it's not half, it's only 40%. And I'm like, 40% is not, 40% is not a good statistic either. Even if it's 30, that's like way, way, way too high. So I've been ranting a lot, but I think about this issue a lot, and I'm curious to know your thoughts.
I think about this issue a lot too, and I agree with everything you have said. I want to say that. Here's the additional piece. I'm not even going to disagree with you. Here's the additional piece is, by ending no-fault divorce as point number two, what we can then turn around and do is incentivize proper marriage. Marriage is supposed to be the only relationship like it on the face of this planet is co-founding a business together. That is the only relationship on this planet that is like forming an actual marriage. So when we look at that, people need to understand that you are forming a co-created legacy, and that is the purpose of marriage. 90% of the research on this was fascinating. I was watching Chris Williamson not that long ago, and he was talking about how of all women who end up not having children, only 10% of them intentionally did not have children. 90% of them intended to and didn't, and now they don't know what to do. Women are still wanting to have children. The millennial age group, the research on this is fascinating. They are the least likely population to have children and the most likely population to want children, which is heartbreaking and tragic as well. It's not that people haven't wanted to get married and have babies and et cetera, whatever marriage looks like to them. It's that, yes, they are incentivized not to. They are fearful of doing so. They don't see the purpose in it. It seems like an endless, stupid risk. Big part of that is no-fault divorce. But once you overturn no-fault divorce, then you can define what divorce can look like, what the problems are, what marriage needs to look like as well. We can incentivize that. I'd say until we have a healthy, thriving society where marriage becomes social pressure instead of state pressure, maybe we appoint Zuby as czar of marriage over the U.S., but we have someone setting policy. We say, look, we've declared an emergency for everything else. We've got a toast emergency and a locust emergency and a COVID emergency. Why don't we have a marriage emergency where our population is dying? Why don't we have a czar of marriage who goes through the government and fights tooth and nail to build marriage policies that will enact strong families, that will show people how amazing marriage is, that will help them build better lives and then help them stay together, and also disincentivize breaking up a marriage? Maybe if there's abuse, there's special little exceptions. There always has been. But you build those strong cases for keeping a family together for life. And the people that don't want to do that, you can go live off over there. No one's gonna force you, please. But for the people who want to build, which the research shows is most men and women, for the people who want to build a family, now they are safe inside doing so. I believe we can balance men and women together, not when they're petrified of each other and have been encouraged to hate and fear each other. We can't do it then, but when we can say men and women want to come together and build families, and here's how to do it, and here's how to feel safe and loved together, and here's your expanded network, and here's all these safety frameworks, please go forth and be fruitful. Right? When that's the case, I think we can do this. So memes and express the knowledge of what is possible and how cool and love marriage is. Get rid of no-fault divorce and then completely overhaul marriage in this country. Yes, at the beginning, probably with the state, because that's all we have left. And then with an eye toward eventually shoving that off onto populations instead and the state stepping back and then set things in motion so they have to, because the state is not very good at giving power back once you give power to the state. So those three things is how I would incentivize marriage, love, connection, and then growing healthier populations. Over time, all of these problems and epidemics we see in our society will go, not go away completely, but they'll go back down to 1% of what they are now, and we will have a healthy, thriving network going forward. That's Elon Musk, if you're listening. That's how we reach Mars.
Hey, well, Adam, firstly, I think you are far more qualified to be marriage czar than I am, for obvious reasons. and we've got your three policies there. Do you want to know what I've landed on this, it might sound radical to people, because I don't know anyone else who's like proposed it publicly, but do you know what I think would make most sense and which would actually satisfy everybody, from religious conservatives to the most secular of atheists? I think there should be two forms of marriage. I think there should be the current legal version, which is essentially a contract with certain benefits and responsibilities, inheritance rights, rights to visit, and so on. And you have the no-fault divorce, right? So, and that can be between any two individuals. That can be, you know, it's a man, a woman, it's a woman, it's a, you know, because people have had that whole fight about same-sex marriage and so on. We have our religious views on that. But it's like, okay, this is a legal contract. So you basically have marriage version one, it should really be two, but which is essentially what the current laws already are, okay? Two consenting adults who are agreeing to enter into this legal contract with its terms and conditions.
Yeah, in the U.S. we call that a civil union. In the U.S., it's not really implemented, but that's what that would be.
Yeah, but now they call it marriage now.
I know.
They basically superseded it by calling it marriage, and then you have marriage two, which is traditional marriage, one man, one woman, no fault divorce. Right? Divorce under certain situations, abuse, adultery, abandonment, maybe addiction, 4 A's, right? These are the situations where you can have a divorce. And that's that. And you can do one, or you can even do both. If you're a religiously inclined conservative person and you're like, you know what, I want to do both. I want to do the covenant marriage and I want to do the legal marriage, then you can do both. If you have no religious inclination at all and whatever, but you've got somebody who you want to do, you know, the life partnership thing with, but you're both like, hey, if it doesn't work out or one of us isn't happy or whatever, we can go our separate ways. But in the meantime, we get these tax breaks and benefits and we can cohabit and so on. Cool. I think that would just make everything better, and it would stop the sort of cross pollution between the two. So in the same way, like a lot of religious people, you know, they're not down with so-called same-sex marriage because they're like, no, that undermines what a marriage even is. Like, that's not even the definition of what a marriage and the union is. Marriage is, and, you know, you'll hear a lot of Christians say, oh, no, you know, it's not a contract, it's a covenant. And it's like, well, legally, it's a contract. It is. Religiously, it's a covenant. But from a legal perspective, they don't give a crap about your covenant. They care about the contract. So why try to keep forcing these things together? Why not parse them out? And you have the covenantal marriage and you have the contractual marriage, and men and women can pick which one they want to go for. And now actually you've satisfied everybody and you're not having them fighting over each other, right? It's just like, hey, cool. You've got that. Call that one a civil union. Call that one a covenantal marriage or a contractual marriage, covenantal marriage. I don't care how you name it, but I think that would actually just satisfy everybody, from conservative to progressive, from secular to super devout religious. I just think that makes sense.
We tried to roll something like this out back in the 1990s and the early 2000s in the US, and the major arguments from both sides, as you might expect, was from the religious conservatives, no, that cheapens marriage. We don't want a second set of marriage, just civil unions. That's stupid. We don't like that. And then from the progressives came, this is separate but not equal. And we are treated as second-class citizens. You are disregarding us and making us out to be subhumans. That was the outcry that came out against this. So then we entered into what we have now, where it's all just mashed up and nobody is happy. I think we had to go through this period of deep unhappiness so that we could all see how awful it is. I believe, Zuby, that actually we're going to come around probably to an arrangement exactly like you're talking about going forward, where there will be civil unions, where there will be protected rights and protected connections for people of any type of relationship, but it will be between two consenting human beings, not a family structure like I've talked about and like you're talking about with the traditionals. There will also be a traditional framework that probably is enhanced for society. Like, this is building our next population. We will recognize these breeding families and whatever it might be. And the breeding stock gets this arrangement over here instead. And most likely that is probably where we are headed next. I suspect that is the case. I wonder how many people will enter into civil unions versus just cohabitating. But if you make the incentives proper, which you should for tax breaks, rights to visit people in the hospital, things like that, to visit a dying person, inheritance rights, et cetera, for a couple, that's all crucial for everybody. I think if you incentivize it properly, that we will have two layers of marriage. And I think that will be more protection for everybody. I tend to agree.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. I think I've thought about this quite a lot, and I'm just like, wouldn't that just make sense and handle all the various objections that come from all the different parties? Because you have people who, so for example, you know, you and I are both like, yeah, get rid of no-fault divorce. It doesn't make sense. There are people who will recoil at that and be like, absolutely not. I would wager that at least 50% of people in America would support no-fault divorce. I don't know the numbers. I'm guessing. I wouldn't be surprised if it's at least half. Because they'll be saying, well, because they have a more secular view of it. They're thinking, well, why should two people stay together if they're miserable? You know, why should people be forced into that situation? So it's like, okay, so have that agreement over there. And at the point of signing up, you pick what you're committing to, and it'll just kind of be a natural filter. The divorce rate in one group would probably stay 40 to 50%. And in the other one, it'll be like under 5%.
This idea that, well, we're in this marriage and we're miserable, so we should call it quits. I think that this is a flawed assumption, because from the work that I've done, people can come in very, 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 very miserable. And if both of them are willing to do the work to resolve the marriage, then it can definitely be resolved. There is, under no-fault divorce, typically a process called irreconcilable differences, which is an exception that you go before a judge and you say, look, we've gone through the process, we've tried to reconcile, we've tried to be reasonable, we've tried to have these conversations, nothing has worked appropriately, and or the other person is unwilling to do any of the work, so I have put in my good faith effort. Then they would usually grant a divorce at that process. But you had to go through the process of actually trying to fix your marriage, learning, for example, attachment issues or resolving conflicts, doing all of those things. They used to make people do that. And the incentive was not keep people in miserable, abusive marriages. The incentive was do your work to actually maintain the relationship that you swore you would hold until the day you die. And that was the expectation before. I think that if we can at least teach people, hey, look, you can resolve almost every single relationship on the face of the earth and become loving and wonderful. It just natural biology flows that way, as long as both of you are willing to do the work. And that's really the challenge there. So I agree with that to that extent, but we need to get away from this, like, I'm not happy, so I'm out. That's the thing I think is killing us.
Yeah. It's incentives though. If, as long as you incentivize that, it's going to happen. I think the incentive structure just needs to be fixed. Adam, man, dude, I could talk to you for a very long time. You're a very knowledgeable and wise man. I want to end on a positive note. Can you give some words of encouragement? So as a married father of five, for any future spouses out there or future parents out there or current ones, what advice is on your heart to share with people?
I'm thinking about just this morning as all of my kids were fighting and playing and delayed me getting to work this morning on time and smearing food on my shirt and messing up my hair after I had prepared it for the podcast, and my wife bouncing around the kitchen happy and everything, and us saying our prayers together, the good and the messy and everything. I will say this to all of the men out there who are listening right now who aren't sure if you want children or not. Do not allow anybody on the face of this earth to make that decision for you. That includes myself and Zuby. Don't allow us to push you into having babies tomorrow if that's not what you're called to. But don't allow fear or the state or bad stories on the internet or even your own past trauma or pain stop you from examining if you want children. Because the amount of richness and warmth and incredible fulfillment that comes from fatherhood, I cannot even begin to convey in the course of an hour and a half podcast. Do not let this decision be made for you. Seek out answers. Ask fathers questions. Maybe sit in with a dad and play with those kids for a while. I know in America, young men, you're not supposed to ever be around kids or you're gross and you're evil. But no, spend some time with kids. Men are meant to play with kids. We are meant to be around children. We are meant to be thriving with family networks. Spend some time around people who have kids and see if it might be for you, because it just might be, and it might be the answer to a lot of your meaninglessness that you have. Don't have children to fix your life. Fix your life to have children, and then look to see if children might be that second mountain that you're looking to climb. Maybe fatherhood is for you.
Nice one, Adam. I love that, man. God bless you, man. I wish you all the best. Where can people find and follow you online?
Yeah, so I'm Adam Lane Smith, the attachment specialist. You can find me on my website, adamlanesmith.com, or I have the attachment repair program, or I can walk you through fixing your challenges. Me and my certified attachment coaches that I've expanded out to, they can help you as well through various programs. I have courses there. I'm also on YouTube at Attachment Adam. I have about 1,000 videos there now showing you how you can build great relationships even in the modern world. Check me out, and I'm here to help.
Love it, man. Great to see you, Adam.
Thank you, Zuby.